Hello and welcome to the Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, The Lord of the Rings trilogy and The Hobbit have collectively grossed billions of dollars in ticket sales, but can they also be a means to understand complex politics and international relations? Then, the planet is facing the worst spate of extinction since the loss of the dinosaurs. Dozens of species are going extinct every day. Should science bring back those species through cloning? Can The Lord of the Rings act as a means to understand complex politics in international relations? Our guest says that it can. Patrick James is a professor at University of Southern California, professor of international relations, and the director of the Center for International Studies. His book is called The International Relations of Middle Earth, Learning from the Lord of the Rings. Welcome, Pat James.
Thank you very much, Maria.
Before we get into the actual politics of Middle Earth, why The Lord of the Rings rather than another narrative to try to explain the theories of international relations?
The short answer is its extraordinary completeness and complexity as a world. If you took all of Tolkien's writings, J.R.R. Tolkien being the author, and put them together, you would have the most completely specified fantasy world that has ever been created. For example, full languages that one can speak, details so accurate that you can chart phases of the moon at different points in the storyline, and they're absolutely correct. So the reason I say that is that the complexity of the story is enough to rival human history itself.
The Lord of the Rings has, I think you wrote in the book, 14 languages. How many different species and storylines and themes?
Depending upon how one would measure such things, literally thousands within the movies, right, which collectively in their extended versions were something like 11 hours long, major, significant, interesting characters and plot lines are literally not even mentioned at all. To film it properly, it would probably go on as a series for several years.
All right, so let's talk about those themes. Justice and order, that's a very big theme in international relations. How are these exemplified in The Lord of the Rings?
It is a constant struggle, Maria, between the two. Often the more of one you have, that is, the more orderly things get, the more unjust and vice versa. And we look at particular storylines and situations in Middle-earth to see how those things trade off, because anyone picking this up and saying, I'd like to get a sense of what international relations is about, the very kinds of conundrums and trade-offs, and I can give examples as you like, that we struggle with in Middle-earth, the characters do, I misspoke, are right there for you and me in the real world. We have to make these decisions all the time. Let's get in a time machine and it's 1994. You are William Jefferson Clinton. You are extremely popular yourself, but you are in trouble with the public and the Congress is in the process of falling to the Republicans. Do you do the right thing in Rwanda, which is to send in a relatively small and cheap force to shut down the genocide? Or alternatively, do you forego justice and preserve your own political position by instead staying out of Rwanda and remembering that the public was still pretty mad about the debacle in Somalia? That question answers itself. Justice and order trading off against each other.
And what about in the book?
In the book, we see an extraordinary and very black and white struggle. This is not a book for people who like shades of gray in that there are very villainous villains and very virtuous heroes. But at the same time, there are flaws. And while there is an ultimate struggle between good and evil in this book, there are really interesting characters who have twists and turns in them. And if we wanted to concentrate on someone, probably the right place to start is Gollum / Sméagol, arguably the most interesting and messed up character in the book.
First of all, let's address the black and white issue. Because isn't it the case where scholars, especially political communication scholars like me, we want to get our audiences to think about things in gray? Does this black and white idea defeat that?
Remember, much of this was written in the first half of the 20th century. This, in some ways, is an assault on moral relativism. If you read the story, you will see that the characters are often tormented. Boromir is a perfect example of this, who wants to preserve the safety of his people in the land of Gondor, but is also struggling with the means toward doing that. In his case, for instance, he finally gives in to his darker nature. He pays with his life. He endangers the entire mission, if you will, of the so-called Fellowship of the Ring. And there we see giving in to evil resulting in a very bad outcome.
So you mentioned Gollum, and you said he exemplifies
He exemplifies within, I think, human nature that there is no absolute determinism, that all of us have the potential for good or evil. Most of our listeners will have a sense of who Gollum is, that he's this extraordinary high-tech character who has a Jekyll and Hyde personality. Smeagol is who he once was originally. He's akin to the delightful little hobbit creatures who are among the most important protagonists. He also has this darker side called Gollum, who is obsessed with the very evil ring of power that jeopardizes the safety of the entire world. And often throughout the story, crucial developments go back and forth in terms of whether the Smeagol part can stay strong enough to assist the Fellowship's members, Frodo in particular, a character we also can talk about, or whether, regrettably, the darker side of Gollum takes over and threatens the world.
You've also written in the book about how Gollum actually represents a certain paradigm or model in international relations. It's the imperialist model. How is that so?
In the storyline, very briefly, Gollum murders another character named Deagle, who is a friend, when they're fishing. Deagle finds the ring. The first act of evil that the ring causes, because of its own inherent evil, is the murder of Smeagol by Gollum. Well, what does that have to do with colonialism? The river folk are simple creatures who live by the river, like to fish, would never hurt anyone. Yet when this high-tech device, arguably, in the fantasy world of Middle-earth, the ring is the WMD, right? It's the weapon of mass destruction. As soon as it is injected into the simple location of the river folk, what happens? Gollum murders his friend. He's obsessed with the ring. He uses its magical powers to disappear, and he becomes cannibalistic, horrendous, and ultimately over 500 years of unnatural extended life due to the fact that he has the ring. He commits many heinous acts. This can be seen as a, if you will, a comparison to the effects of very high technologies going into parts of the world that were innocent and pristine and causing terrible things to happen. Some people have read the book that way.
So now that's one of the many ways of looking at international relations, and you have characters representing the other models, realism, for example, the liberalism. Who do you see as representing realism?
Realism, a particular form of it that's very aggressive, called offensive realism. It's a sense that people live for the gain of power relative to others, that they want to expand, if you will, that they're naturally quite imperialistic. A storyline example involving the two wizards, Saruman, who's gone over to the dark side and is starting to help the Dark Lord and scheme with him. He's been overtaken by Sauron's rising power, versus Gandalf, who is the unofficial leader of the free peoples who resist Sauron. They have a terrible confrontation, and a concept such as bandwagoning plays a key role in offensive realism, as in, it is appropriate for me to bandwagon, that is, roll down the hill and join the side that's winning. Saruman, if makes a long, impassioned plea to Gandalf, which is really extremely dishonest and sneaky, of course, as in, we should join Sauron. He's going to win anyway. Let's do that. This communicates a very old concept and one with a lot of staying power in international relations, that we see bandwagoning. For example, smaller states that joined in with Hitler's Germany, during its early days of successful conquest, certain parties join in with Hitler rather than balancing against him. Saruman, the wizard who's gone over to the dark side, bandwagons with the evil and incredibly powerful Sauron, whereas Gandalf speaks for another version of realism called balancing, as in, both are about power, but it's about how you choose to deploy your power. Saruman says, let's cave in and divide up the spoils of Sauron. Gandalf says, very unwise, let us balance against him because he does not share power.
Now, you said that Gandalf in the book was actually a representative of what we call in political science rational choice. And yet, wouldn't a rational choice person want to bandwagon with the side that's winning?
If they calculate properly, the correct answer is no, interestingly enough, because they also can look ahead rather than being myopic and say, what Gandalf did, as in, it might sound great to be on the so-called winning team, but siding with someone like Hitler, that is bandwagoning with him or Sauron in the fantasy world, is a lot like feeding a crocodile, hoping that he will eat you last. So the rational thing to do is to actually join the weaker side and try to balance, because either you must, as one of the American revolutionaries said, you must hang together or hang separately.
My favorite model is constructivism. How can we see the international relations theory of constructivism in The Lord of the Rings?
We see it in so many places. Constructivism is about studying ideas and saying, hey, you know what? It's not just guns and tanks and planes or even nuclear weapons that matter. It's the power of ideas. And if we look at the story of The Lord of the Rings, here's one example of this. Frodo, who is the ring bearer, is looking at the world around him, and you'll notice we can introduce multiple theories with a single character. He has to come up with an idea about what his world is all about. Is it about black and white, good and evil? He must, in other words, construct the world. And as he grew up, if you will, in this very idealistic sort of throwback to early modern England, very pastoral place called the Shire, right? Everybody farms. There's no ugly machinery or industry. He must reconstruct his view because here's his initial view until he begins to have his adventures and gets involved in the Lord of the Rings story. Who cares about the outside world? It doesn't concern us here in the Shire. Many would call that a construction of isolationism. Whereas he begins to construct a more liberal, cooperative worldview, as in, I must join in with this fellowship, because even though we hobbits, we little wee creatures who live in our simple shire, would like to stay there and we'd like to be left alone, that isn't realistic anymore. So he learns and he discovers and he changes his worldview, and so too do other companions of his.
And it's all interconnected.
It is interconnected. It is interdependent, as the so-called liberal theorists of IR would tell us. Do not try to pretend, especially under conditions of globalization, that there are little airtight compartments in this world and we can stay in one and keep the rest of them out.
Let me just remind listeners that we are speaking with Patrick James, and the book is called The International Relations of Middle-Earth, Learning from the Lord of the Rings. And this is The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. There are other models, then. You actually have found a character for almost every one of them. The critical theory. How do you find critical theory in The Lord of the Rings?
Critical theory is not, say, in the sense of Newton or Galileo trying to explain our universe like a natural scientist would, but instead it's looking at IR more as a philosopher might in terms of what is right and wrong. So how in this fantasy world, and bear in mind Tolkien, who wrote this material before anybody even used the words critical theory. What's so fascinating about his fantasy world is that you will find theories that have been created very recently that, amazingly enough, storylines represent. A great character to talk about here is someone who doesn't make it into the movies. And his name is Old Man Willow. He's kind of a cantankerous cousin to the Ents. The Ents are these large, mobile, tree-like creatures who ultimately, by the way, do join the good guys and help out. Old Man Willow actually is really quite nasty and mean. And in a storyline that's left out, we see him trying to devour the little hobbits early in their time away from the Shire. They're still quite ignorant of the outside world. They tend to be innocents. They might lie down near the roots of the tree, and then they risk being devoured and gnarled to death. Well, then where does critical theory come in? To Old Man Willow, intruders in his domain called the Old Forest always mean trouble. What do? They burn the trees. They chop them down. This, of course, is critical theory expressed in terms of environmentalism. Old Man Willow seems like a villain, doesn't he? He's trying to devour these hobbits. But now we transport ourselves to his domain. What is happening to him? People are coming into his territory, even right next to his doorstep, and they're pulling out axes and cutting him or his relatives down. And what the book does is, Old Man Willow is a sentient creature. So it encourages us, from a critical theory standpoint, to step out of the idea that trees are just wood waiting to happen for our fireplace. Maybe, for example, we might want to rethink what we're doing with the Amazon.
And then also it brings in the issues of justice and the entire system and how the system works to be either just or unjust, and feeds into conflict.
You are absolutely right. And the book is also a wonderful and interesting struggle between myself and my wonderful collaborator, Abigail Ruane. Mm-hmm. She's a very fine scholar. She is more devoted to critical theory, whereas I am much more on the sort of, call it, if you will, natural science side of things. She's more interested in justice. I'm more interested in order, not to the exclusion of the other.
I assume then that it was your co-author that actually integrated feminism.
Yes, we're obviously as different as you could get in our approaches. So each one serves as a naturally wonderful critic for the other. So the book tends to have, in my humble opinion, a very pragmatic and balanced sense between order and justice. As in, we do not obsess over justice to the point where we worry that everybody always has the same things all of the time. And at the same time, we're not so callous that we want order badly enough that we don't care if one person has everything. The tricky thing, as we know in the real world, Maria, is where is that appropriate balance in any given context?
And do you have a sense that The Lord of the Rings allows that debate to come through?
Precisely, because if you look at the hierarchy of power, you have different races, if you will, call them ethnicities, more in our term. You have the humans. You have the elves, who are very long-lived, extremely intellectual, erudite, very distant. But also, they have flaws, such as being condescending and somewhat self-absorbed. At the other end of things, you have the hobbits, who are pint-sized, physically not very strong, and generally not very knowledgeable, with a few exceptions about the outside world. And then much more fantastic creatures, dwarves, for instance, who are short, but actually physically quite powerful, incredible engineers, but here's their flaw. They are obsessed with wealth. Notice the problem here that they might not care much about justice as long as they have a lot. And then you have characters that go over the edge into evil. The so-called orcs, and here we come back to the question of moral relativism, are in fact completely evil. They have no redeeming characteristics, and that, of course, is a very extreme kind of character to have.
And the orcs you described as part of the realist model prototype. How are they?
There is a memorably evil character who has a very exciting confrontation in the movie version with Aragorn, one of the most heroic characters we haven't mentioned. He is the king in waiting, the leader of the free peoples. He has a confrontation with the leader of a particular type of hybrid orc, very powerful, stronger than normal orcs, larger and capable of traveling in daylight. These rather miserable and abominable creatures abhor the sun, and the particular type of orc called the Uruk-hai does not. And the Uruk-hai leader epitomizes realism in that he goes on a murderous rampage, all he cares about offensively, destroying his enemies. In other words, he's monomaniacal. He wants power. He wants to destroy things. He does not have any concerns for justice. To him, the order is the Uruk-hai dominate and the free peoples are to be destroyed.
He almost sounds like he belongs in another model, in the traditional imperialist model.
In the high era of imperialism in the 19th century, the great powers of Europe sailed the seas, took over what they, in a kind of bad reading of Charles Darwin, saw as extremely inferior people, colonized them. They didn't understand the places they were colonizing very well. But you can look at a sort of neo-colonial type of assessment through these rampages, in particular going into places and savaging them that had previously been undisturbed. Another storyline, Maria, that is not in the movies, it's called the Scouring of the Shire. What happens, sadly enough for the hobbits, when the hobbits go back home to their idyllic shire, it is not like it is in the movie. In the book, it has been taken over by a decrepit, pathetic, reduced version of the evil Saruman. He and his minions have now, and get this point closely, they have created an ugly industrial shire. It's filthy, it's polluted, its beautiful trees, its wonderful meadows are full of industrial waste. There's smoke everywhere. In a sense, what this is pointing out also about war and its consequences is there is no victory without also loss. That the Shire, when they come back, they have to fight another rearguard battle to destroy Saruman's occupying force of evil men. And they do. The hobbits are now, because of their battle-hardened experience, able to come back. They lead a hobbit rebellion. Things are repaired, but some hobbits have died, and some beautiful things. In particular, if you recall the bridge between the hobbit and the Lord of the Rings, the party where Bilbo leaves, there is something called the party tree. It's a big, beautiful tree. It has been destroyed and turned into firewood.
I know you said your co-author wrote the feminist chapter, but I wonder, Lord of the Rings didn't have much presence of women at all. And I wonder if that is part of the feminist critique of international relations theory as well.
To give the women even a smidgen of airtime, they actually have to change some storylines. In the book, for instance, there's a memorable rescue scene where the character Arwen, who is the, if you will, the partner ultimately for Aragorn, the king, she's an elf, and she does not rescue Frodo from the Dark Riders. He's been stabbed. He's going to turn into, if you will, a sort of ghastly zombie-like creature. He needs desperately to get to where the elves have their sanctuary and their very powerful medicine. He's rescued by the beautiful Arwen in the movie, but a character, a male elf actually, named Glorfindel rescues Frodo in the book version. Arwen's character, for example, is really pumped up in the movies compared to what she would be in the books. And few female characters that really matter. Galadriel is not exaggerated. We haven't mentioned her yet. She is arguably the most powerful single entity in Middle-earth. She's an elf and an ancient one. Unless Sauron can get that ring we've been talking about, if he gets it, all of the world falls to him. Galadriel possesses a second-tier ring and is incredibly powerful, very wise. Eowyn is the leading feminist character in the book. It's actually quite fascinating to think of how long ago this book was written. And she is as close as you could get to being a sort of female Ivanhoe knight-like character. She wants to fight alongside the men. She's quite vigorous and capable of doing so, but they won't let her. She actually has to disguise herself and assume the identity of a phony knight called Durnhelm. She becomes a warrior from her kingdom, Rohan. The Rohan people are riders. They're very Norse. They remind you, if you will, of people who would live in a Viking type of environment, and they're great horsemen, and she actually has to disguise herself, and she plays a crucial role in a very late battle scene in the movie. If she isn't there, there's a saying about these horrible black riders that were pursuing Frodo at one point. The leader of them cannot be killed by a man. He is ultimately slain by Eowyn and a small hobbit who was not going to be allowed to fight either. And they, in other words, the feminist critique is, there are women who can do things that men can do. Now here's where some of my feminist friends would get annoyed and say, wait, you left out something. This is called liberal feminism. The idea is that you and I should have equal opportunities, as should everyone, and you might then try to excel in the ways I might try to excel. Different variants or strands of feminism actually object to this, say, no, women actually are different. And here we get into another storyline, if that's all right, that's not in the movies, in the books. The Entwives. Remember I mentioned those large, fantastic living trees? They're all guys. They're all masculine because the Entwives left. They found the Ents and their obsession with trees annoying. The Entwives thought that gardens were more exciting. There, notice the environmentalism again. But notice also, although Tolkien could not possibly have anticipated this, one strand of feminism argues that the liberal model, where everybody should just have an equal opportunity and try to excel, say, in a democratic capitalist type of society, that's one kind of feminism. But another one would say, we want to be different. Actually, we don't want to obsess over what you historically have obsessed over. We have different goals. Even those nuances can be found, and I return to my first point, how many novels out there have this degree of internal complexity where we can get into sub-variants of explanations of our world and we find entire characters or races that help us with them.
And speaking of complexity, the other aspect of this book, the levels of looking at, you call them levels of analysis, it's kind of a scholarly term, how to really understand conflict. You said in The Lord of the Rings, just like in World War I, you can look at it from these various perspectives. You can look at the big system, like what are the systemic reasons why World War I happened, similar in The Lord of the Rings. You can look at it from the kind of structural elements, like the state, and you can look at it from the individual, like the young man who decided to shoot the Archduke.
That's right, and what's so fascinating, I'll just give one historical comparison. If you look at things that are true to all three of the wars that we choose to look at, they're very well-known cases. Obviously, the War of the Ring from the fantasy world, why did it happen? And then the causes as well of the World War I that you just mentioned, but also the war in Iraq, which is more recent in our times. One of the things that is in The Lord of the Rings, as well as those other two cases, people have argued that the wars were precipitated by weak and or experienced and or bad leaders, quote unquote, who showed poor judgment. World War I, we have a combination of decrepit empires and monarchical systems where it wasn't the best and the brightest, right, who are in leadership. It was old, decrepit monarchs like the Kaiser, for instance, in Germany, the Tsar in Russia, who, because they are there only through privilege and not competence, are really not very skilled in diplomacy, not very able to prevent the outbreak of World War I after that assassination you referred to. Now, Iraq, not a partisan statement, but I think it has been said fairly that George Bush, 43, was not an experienced foreign policy president. He tended to listen, arguably, to people who really wanted to precipitate the war. Perhaps he moved impetuously without appropriate evidence regarding WMDs. That can be seen as weak and inexperienced leadership. Later on, the intelligence was proven not to have been there. Now, here's the fun part. If you're trying to get these ideas and compare them, The Lord of the Rings has its own decrepitude to talk about as well. Remember Gandalf, the leader of the Free Peoples? Actually, he has no official position. Other leaders won't listen to him. The two monarchs from the kingdoms I have referenced, Rohan and Gondor, they have, in one case, Gondor is the more powerful of the two Free Peoples kingdoms. They have Denethor, who has gone mad. He has been seduced, if you will, by the evil of Sauron. The leader of Rohan has been bewitched by an agent of Saruman, another wizard who I had mentioned. Gandalf is fighting furiously. He's pursuing diplomacy to get these weaker, incompetent leaders to listen to him, as in, we're going to be really in a deep, dark place if we do not prepare properly for the war that's coming. And for various kinds of complex reasons, the incompetence weakens the Free People and makes them more prone to a war they will lose. Notice that the comparison with Iraq and 1914 is really quite apt. You've got weak leadership and incompetence, and war ensues. Now, one might say, hey, Tolkien cheated. He was making this all up about World War I. If he was still alive, he would get quite cranky with us for saying this. But how about that? You can't say anything about Iraq. He never saw Iraq. It happened 30 years after he was gone.
I'd like to end with what you began the book with, which is in this election in Iran, that when there was considerable consternation about how the election went, that the state aired the Lord of the Rings in an effort to pacify people, but it didn't have that effect. What happened?
The tremendous irony is that while the state, the Ahmadinejad regime, says, well, let's throw the people a bone. They don't get many Western movies. These movies are hotter than the sun. Everybody's watching. This is, of course, years after they came out in the West, right? They come out in the early 2000s. This is 2009. Here's the irony. The state puts the movies out there, but they should have had some of their own people watch them very carefully first, because what the movies do, more than anything else, the movies are about human or personal freedom. They argue in favor of democracy and honest practices and fair treatment, as in a combination of order and justice. They would hardly be something you would show people to try to calm them down. And what happens, of course, is a boomerang effect. People look at these movies and they see messages within them, as in, we ought to resist. You know, we shouldn't be pacified by this. Yes, we're entertained. Of course, it's a sword and sorcery fantasy movie. Arguably, it's the best long movie ever made. The Return of the King won Best Picture. So it's a great action movie, and yes, they were right to entertain, but I think they would have been better off showing Top Gun or something out of Schwarzenegger if they wanted to shut people down.
Well, thank you so much, Patrick James, for being with us. Again, the book is called The International Relations of Middle Earth, Learning from the Lord of the Rings. When we come back, should science bring back some species from extinction? Stay tuned.
Party.
Hello, you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Planet Earth is facing the worst spate of extinction since the loss of the dinosaurs, according to the Center for Biological Diversity. Dozens of species are going extinct every day, and more face extinction with the onset of climate change. These realities have given rise to some scientists exploring the possibility of de-extinction, bringing back some species through cloning. Should it be done? Is it ethical? Is it practical? We're joined by three experts. Michael Archer is a professor of biological, earth, and environmental sciences at the University of New South Wales. He has published more than 300 scientific journal articles focusing on the ecology and evolution of past and present, and has been working to bring back some extinct animals. John Weens is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona and author of numerous publications and the book, The Ecology of Bird Communities. He is also a former curator at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History and has served as editor for a number of scientific journals. Carl Zimmer also joins us. He's an award-winning lecturer at Yale University and the author of 13 books, including his latest, A Planet of Viruses, and Evolution, the Triumph of an Idea. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, Time Magazine, National Geographic, and Scientific American. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with what the scope is that we're facing with regards to mass extinction on the planet. I understand it's pretty unprecedented. Michael Archer, is this something you can help us to understand?
I'm a paleontologist, and certainly we've been documenting the dreadful outcomes of the previous five mass extinctions the planet suffered. Sometimes it's taken out 85% of the creatures on the planet. But there are intimations already that the sixth great extinction is underway, and we're the cause. And the rate at which things are going extinct at the moment appears as unprecedented as anything we've ever seen before. It's roughly the equivalent of when that meteor came in and took out the big non-flying dinosaurs.
Except for we don't have a meteor right now.
Well, we're the meteor, unfortunately, and we're really hitting the planet hard. It's a thing we have to take seriously into consideration. You know, if it's us doing it, then we've got to really ask ourselves, do we know what we're doing here? One of the footnotes to this that's disturbing is in the previous five mass extinctions, on average, it takes 10 million years for the planet to stabilize its ecosystems again. And you really have to ask, are we prepared to have that happen on the other side of what we're doing on the planet at the moment?
I know climate change is a big cause of extinction. What are the other activities that we are doing that is creating this problem?
One of the saddest things, unfortunately, has to do with what we perceived 10,000 years ago was the appropriate way for humans to feed themselves. And that meant we started to focus on a very few species that we could grow and stockpile, and through this, increase our own numbers. This is agriculture. In order to get agriculture, every continent on which this has been inflicted, we've swept aside the natural ecosystems and the species along with them in order to plant very few of these foreign species that were introduced to all the other continents. Australia was one of the last ones to have this affliction, but it's suffering now. We've lost 18 of our precious mammals, largely because of land clearing. But then along with that, of course, we have introduced onto every continent a few animal species that we have valued, like sheep and cattle, and moved all the natives aside until eventually they've had no room to survive, and we see this terrible cascade of extinctions following hard on the heels of agriculture.
John Weens.
You know, my understanding is that we're estimating now that we're going to lose between maybe 50%, maybe 67% of all the species that are on the planet now, even though we don't have a clear idea of how many species that is. I think Michael's exactly right. The big problem seems to be habitat destruction, or at least people are estimating that we're going to lose half or two-thirds of all the species on the planet just considering habitat destruction alone. And that's not sort of thinking about climate change. It's sort of a wild card. We don't know what it's going to do. But it's particularly frightening because we can set up reserves and national parks to protect habitats, obviously from habitat destruction, but then lots of species may go extinct inside those reserves and national parks because of climate change.
Carl Zimmer.
The dire situation that we're facing is actually causing conservation biologists to give serious thought to the traditional ways that they have tried to preserve species. As John mentioned, the traditional thing would be to set up a preserve. But if climate totally changes the conditions in that preserve, then you haven't done much good. And so one idea that people have is that you might move some of those species to places where they might have a better chance of surviving, sometimes called assisted migration. But the problem there is that there may not necessarily be any place to move them where they have all the right conditions to survive. So these biologists are really grappling with just how truly serious the situation is.
And so scientists are exploring all these different aspects of it. And one of them that triggered this program today specifically dealt with the de-extinction efforts. Michael Archer, you're one of the leaders on this. What are the advances scientifically that are making it possible to bring animals back from extinction, or maybe not even just animals, maybe plant species?
Yeah, there's an awful lot of opportunities that are opening up. I raised this question, back in about 2000 when I was very interested in knowing whether we could recover the DNA from one of Australia's iconic animals. It's kind of our king of beasts, called the thylacine or Tasmanian tiger. And when I asked, could we get that DNA back out of a pickled specimen that we had, which theoretically was possible, there was just laughter. And that was barely 13 years ago. Now, technology has streaked ahead. George Church, in his book Regenesis, has outlined many of the new technologies, the new machines that can work with fragmented DNA. There is letter-by-letter gene replacement techniques that enable you to work with, say, the genetic understanding of a living animal and change it step-by-step to match the recovered DNA from an extinct animal. So there are so many new and exciting things happening. There are other people also traveling under this banner of de-extinction that are involved in kind of trying to deconstruct living animals to see what's in their ancestry behind the living animal. The living animal still carries the genes of extinct ancestors. And increasingly, it's possible through selective breeding to start to recover those ancient genes and hopefully begin to bring back one of the prehistoric animals. There are other groups that are looking at even de-extincting environments. I mean, we're talking here now about bringing back a mammoth or a thylacine or a frog, but it's also possible to think about bringing back whole ecosystems. Much of the instability that affects the planet at the moment is because we've had what are called trophic cascades. You extinct some key animal, and then a whole lot of other things that depended on it also disappear. So there are other people working on trying to, for example, bring back the Pleistocene world that used to be here 10,000 years ago and see if you can reinstall it in Siberia. These are all such exciting projects, and nobody's laughing anymore. They're possible.
There are some people who think that maybe it's not really practical or not really ethical. You've responded that you think it is ethical and practical. Let's start with that argument.
I think it's more than practical and possible. I do have a very strong feeling that if we can see the finger of man, if you like, as the responsible factor for why some of these iconic species are gone, then I feel we have a moral responsibility, and I'd even argue a moral imperative, if we can be smart human, to start to undo the time when we played inappropriately like gods and exterminated species, then I think we have this moral imperative to try to do that. This isn't just toys or fun or just seeing what we can do. We're actually trying to fix what we broke. And that, to me, is very important.
John Weems, you've expressed some skepticism about this. What are your concerns?
I think it's actually a great and a wonderful thing. But at the same time, I don't think it should be the highest priority. The highest priority should be to preserve species in their natural environments. And when we do that, that's how we're going to preserve the maximum number of species in the shortest amount of time and the minimum cost. As some people say, try to save all the pieces rather than trying to put things back together again. I think the second line of defense is zoos, you know, once things are still alive but maybe can't be in the wild anymore. And then I think the de-extinction is a wonderful third route, but I would say that it should be the lowest priority.
Can I pop into that one, John? I agree with you about that. But on the other hand, if we do this sequentially, if we say, first, we're going to try to keep them in the wild, and if that doesn't work, well, hang on, we'll keep them alive in the zoos. And if that doesn't work, oh, well, let's go back to square one and maybe try to bring something back from the dead. But these are parallel activities. I don't see them as alternatives. I can't see any reason why, because different monies are involved, different kinds of support are going on here, why we shouldn't be trying de-extinction projects simultaneously with maintaining that commitment to conserving living species. And in the process, what we're finding, what I heard at the Revive and Restore and De-Extinction events National Geographic was running, were that people are talking about cross-species cloning. This is a key to de-extinction projects. And that actually is an extremely important tool for modern conservationists to increase the numbers of endangered species by taking cells from the endangered species, popping them into a common related species, and getting more of the endangered species back into the world. So I see these as compatible strategies rather than alternatives.
Carl Zimmer, what is it that you're hearing from the rest of the scientific community?
The other people I'm talking to are discussing these very issues. Another thing that comes up in my discussions with scientists is the question of what it really means to bring something back from extinction. Because if you just make one animal, well, that's a scientifically an impressive feat. But one animal is not a species. A species is a viable population that can sustain itself. And if you create just enough to survive in a zoo, for example, well, some scientists would say, well, that's kind of functionally extinct. And we actually have some species right now where they're basically only in zoos. It's not really what you think of when you think of biodiversity. So really, ultimately, the real test of de-extinction for a lot of scientists would be actually being able to put something back out in the wild. And there again, it's a very tricky issue because if they became extinct because of something that happened in their habitat, if that habitat is still a mess, then you might just watch them going extinct again. And there are diseases that have broken out that have driven a number of species extinct, frogs, a number of frog species, for example. They're still out there, and nobody has any good way to cure these diseases that are caused by fungi. So if you were to bring back a frog, as Dr. Archer is doing, who's to say that you put it out in the wild and they all die of the same fungus again? So these are the kinds of questions that de-extinction is raising.
John Weems?
I agree with both Carl and Mike, but I think there does need to be this hierarchy that the first and most important priority is preserving the habitat. Again, like Carl said, if you de-extinct something, you have to have a place to put it besides just a zoo or a laboratory. There has to be a habitat for it. There has to be an environment. And so I think that is the first priority in terms of preservation. And I agree with Michael that these things can be going on in parallel, but I do think strongly that there has to be a sort of a hierarchy or I think that there's the way to get the most bang for the buck in terms of preserving biodiversity is going to be from protecting habitats.
Let's take a slight turn and talk about what has been done. Michael Archer, you've got this project, the Lazarus Project. I think that's the one in which you are bringing the frog back. How close are you to doing this?
Well, a lot closer than we expected to be when we started this project, I have to say. This is a kind of a classic cloning project, but it's different than Dolly the sheep. Dolly involved taking a live sheep body cell and using the DNA from that to put into a live sheep egg cell. And, you know, it was a miracle when it happened in 1996, but suddenly there was a cloned sheep. What we're trying to do, and so far have amazingly succeeded, at least far as we've gotten, is to take the nucleus from a dead cell from an extinct species. We have some old frozen tissue that was shoved in a freezer between 30 and 40 years ago, and then take that dead nucleus and put it into the egg cell of a living frog of a different kind. So it's cross-species cloning. We had no reason to expect it was going to work because of all of the obvious new challenges involved. But amazingly to us, after only probably 400 or 500 of these injections, one of these suddenly divided, and then it kept dividing and eventually produced an embryo that is the sort of precursor to developing a tadpole. But it didn't go on to produce a tadpole. It just stopped at that point. And that is our hurdle. We have done parallel experiments working with living frogs, so no dead tissues involved. And when we do the same things with them, they also stop at that same stage. So we suspect we've got a technological problem in front of us now, nothing to do with a problem with the extinct frog's DNA. But how long before we actually get a tadpole and a frog? You know, we're out at the edge, beyond the edge of the known in terms of doing things like this. So we don't have any signposts. We don't have any guidelines to tell us. We're just guessing. But considering we've got this far in what amounts to basically only about a month and a half of work, albeit spread over a five-year period, I'm kind of hopeful in the next few years we're going to have this frog hopping glad to be back in the world again. One of the things that we hope to be able to do is get this frog back in the wild. And I think what John and Carl are saying are critical. We need to know that all of this effort is going to have that potential outcome. And for us, that's probably going to involve selective breeding in the laboratory colony for resistance to that fungus. Many frogs around the world are starting to show this resistance. But in those cases, there are thousands of frogs. Most of them go, but a few show resistance, and the next generation breeds from those. We'd hope to be able to do that artificially in a lab so that the gastric brooding frog, which is what we're trying to get back here, that gets put back in the wild, will be able to stick its tongue out at that fungus and survive.
Suppose you're successful with this particular frog. How do you choose which animal to bring back from extinction on the next round?
There's a lot of thinking about that, and I can only say what our attitude has been in the Lazarus Project, and that is, you know, A, did we as humans drive it extinct, so that puts it on our candidate list. Two, is it a really distinctive animal? In other words, in this case, this frog represented a whole family of frogs, so it's a very unique chunk of the global genomic diversity of the world. So if we could get this back, it's not just another frog, it's a very special frog. And there's a third reason in this case, which is not necessarily applicable to all these other candidates. In this case, this frog also did something so amazing that humans are interested in understanding how it did this in order to see how it might benefit us. These frogs converted their stomach into a uterus. They raised their young in their stomach. And that was so amazing to the medical fraternity that they wanted to research this, find out how it did it, and suddenly it was extinct. So a lot of reasons why you would pick particular species to focus this attention on.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about whether or not scientists should try to bring back some extinct species through cloning. Let's go back to the ecosystem issue. John Means, when an animal goes extinct in a particular ecosystem, and we talked briefly about sometimes it collapses, sometimes it doesn't, but generally it's changed when an animal is extinct in an ecosystem. What generally happens? What kind of changes do we see? And then what would happen if you reintroduced it, say, 40 years or 400 years later?
Wow, that's tough. It's going to depend a lot, I think, on the species that you're talking about. It may be that in some cases, there isn't necessarily a huge impact. In other cases, some species we call keystone species, a lot of other species depend on them. And so removing them could be devastating. So it's going to vary a lot from species to species of how much overall effect they have on an ecosystem.
Carl Zimmer, would you say the scientific community is on one side or on another of this, or are they split down the middle?
I really think it's too early to say. For a lot of scientists, they're only becoming aware that this is actually even feasible right now. With the article in National Geographic and the meeting that was held recently for TEDx, this is really the first time that these issues have been brought up outside of script room where somebody is coming up with the next episode of Jurassic Park. So when I talk to people, often they're just trying to think about this kind of in the hypothetical and then try to sort of move from the hypothetical to the possible. It reminds me of what was happening in the early 1970s when scientists were fiddling around with enzymes. And they realized that they could move a gene from one species into another. And so they took a gene from a frog and they stuck it into E. coli. So suddenly you had this almost like a microbe-frog hybrid. Suddenly scientists had gone from thinking, well, this might be interesting, to seeing that this could really happen. And then suddenly the whole scientific community started getting involved in the big discussion of what would become known as genetic engineering. And that took a few years. There were a lot of concerns raised about the possible risks and a lot of big promises that were made. And, you know, the big promises never came through. The big warnings never materialized. But there was something sort of in between. You know, that may be how things develop here, but we're really just at the beginning of that conversation.
One of the other phrases that I saw Michael Archer was this idea of the global genome. You've said that perhaps we conserve as much of the global genome as we can for the purpose of giving the world resilience. For the non-scientists among us, what exactly is the global genome? Is this the entirety of DNA? And does it necessarily give the world resistance?
Yeah, it's a very interesting concept. Biologically, of course, is the focus that I have. But it actually is a cultural focus. It could be an economic focus. I think all of us, no matter what discipline we're actually working in, understand that simple systems are prone to being tipped over. The less resilient the base for whatever system, whether it's cultural, economic, biological, however broad that base is, we give greater stability to what it is we depend on that's built on that base. And biological systems are pretty much the same. The more you simplify them by taking species out or by reducing the amount of diversity or space that they have to operate in, the greater the probability that a simple little push or a shove coming in from outside will tip the whole thing over. The global financial crisis was a similar thing. I think for most people in the world, we all wondered how on earth could something as catastrophic as that happen from what seemed to be simple drivers. And yet it was about simplification. It was about taking away the resilience of the system, and it can fall over. Life systems are the same. The global genome, the bigger and broader it is, the more life has, if you like, in its bag of tricks, the more capacity it has to respond to changes in the environment or changes in the world. While we're obliterating the comfortable climate zones that the planet has, we need to know life has got the toolkit to be able to respond and survive these changes. And if we've taken away a lot of its tools, more of it's going to fall over when the crisis hits.
I would like to hear John Wien's response to that. If, in fact, we can conserve this global genome and it does give the world resistance, does it give us the justification for moving forward on this kind of project?
I think that there may be two separate issues. And one is, I strongly agree with Michael, that there's a strong scientific basis for saying that more biodiverse systems, like more biodiverse ecosystems, seem to be more resilient to change. And also, they do more for us. There's this important idea of ecosystem function. And functioning natural ecosystems do so many things for us. They purify our water. They give us oxygen. They give us food. They do all these things that it would be impossible to pay for. Just a natural functioning ecosystem just does all these amazing things. And it seems to be that not only are functioning diverse ecosystems more resilient, but they also do more. They function better. So that's a strong argument for preserving biodiversity. I think it's maybe another question whether de-extincting some species is going to be a major part of that, if it's going to have enough, you know, effects on the ecosystem to make a sort of a big difference on the global scale. But I think in the end, I think we all want the same thing, is that we do want to preserve as much diversity as possible.
Michael Archer, when you de-extinct a particular, say, animal, there are a couple of concerns that have been raised. One is whether or not that animal is going to have fundamental flaws, kind of like Dolly the sheep did or others, or even when people inbreed animals, they tend to have these congenital illnesses. Is that a big risk? And then the second one is animals over time evolve and adapt to an environment socially. Is that coded in the DNA that you are then using, or is that something that is learned?
Yeah, those are fascinating questions. And of course, to a certain extent, I guess we're only going to discover these through the trial and error of doing work of this kind. And in response to your first question, unquestionably, there are going to be unacceptable outcomes for some of the early experiments in de-extincting. In fact, the Pyrenean ibex this is the Bucardo, it's a goat. It was cloned nearly 10 years ago from the last individual that died, had been, in fact, hit by a tree. And the offspring from that actually came out with an extra bit of a lung, and it didn't work. But most technologies like this always start out with flaws, and then as you understand more about the processes, they get better and better with less flaws and more efficiency. Cloning is now standard in agriculture. People are doing it all the time to produce perfectly healthy cattle, arguably cattle, for example, that are even going to live longer than normal cattle. There's amazing things here. So I'm not terribly worried about that. The beginnings of these new technological things like IVF and all these other things always have hiccups to start, and then they get sorted out, and then everybody begins to take it for granted. But your second question is equally interesting. To what extent, when we bring back an extinct animal, particularly one that there may be no actual memories of how these animals behaved, supposing we do manage to get back a mammoth, are we actually going to know whether that mammoth is behaving like a mammoth or not? I'm not sure it matters too much. I do know that a lot of animal behavior is definitely hardwired into the genome. When you think about cats, you know, we don't buy adult cats. We tend to buy kittens, and they barely have their eyes open. They haven't done anything except lick their mother's milk. And yet when that kitten grows up with no training or anything else, suddenly there's all these horrible behaviors about mutilating mice. They know exactly what to do. It's hardwired behavior. My guess is we'll find that's true for most animals. We look at the animal kingdom through our own eyes, and we think about all of the behaviors we have that are learned, and we assume that's true for everything else, and it's not. About 95% of the behavior of most animals in the rest of the world is hardwired. It's instinctual. So I think if we get some of these extinct animals back, I'd expect the vast majority of those behaviors to simply click straight in.
Carl Zimmer, you get the last word.
We're talking about an extinction crisis that is affecting perhaps thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe ultimately even millions of species. And the work that's involved to bring back even one species from extinction is huge. You know, we really have to ask just how practical it can be to try to bring back these species, to figure out the biology, to work out the cloning, and all the rest, to bring back sort of a handful of species. That doesn't necessarily mean we shouldn't do it. It just might mean that we can't pretend that we could somehow make up even a tiny part of the deficit we're going to be facing. That being said, one way that the extinction might actually prove to be very powerful might actually be really psychological. Because if people see the frog that Mike Archer is trying to bring back, or if they see a passenger pigeon, or if they see a woolly mammoth, that's going to make them think about all the species that are not with us and all the species that we're about to lose. And maybe that will lead to more of a broad-based change in people's attitudes. That's going to be what's going to let us deal with the extinction crisis.
John Weems.
You can imagine it working exactly in reverse and people saying, oh, we don't need to worry about preserving things in the wild or in zoos because we can just bring them back.
Carl Zimmer, Michael Archer, and John Weems, I'd like to extend a very big thank you for joining us on this and helping us understand this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Archer is a professor of biological earth and environmental sciences at the University of New South Wales. He has published more than 300 scientific journal articles focusing on the ecology and evolution of past and present and has been working to bring back some extinct animals. John Weems is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona and author of numerous publications and the book, The Ecology of Bird Communities. Carl Zimmer is an award-winning lecturer at Yale University and the author of 13 books, including his latest, A Planet of Viruses and Evolution, The Triumph of an Idea. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chiprinankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at armudian.